And we're back here on Unusual Sources, 93.3 CFMU FM, bringing you the news from around the world and the community. And what a way to do it. Today, we have one of our favorite guests, David Jacobs. He's a labor and professional regulations lawyer, international human rights lawyer, a McMaster graduate, in fact. We're glad always to have alumni on the program. So, David, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you for the kind introduction.
David, I know there's a lot going on issues that are of great concern to you, international law, human rights, war, illegal wars, preventing wars. Certainly anyone who's been following politics in England, the UK, the Jeremy Corbyn campaign for leadership of the Labour Party and the subsequent events, we've all had a lot to talk about, even though people in Hamilton or Canada in general may not be well informed on this issue. I have already read some articles by Chris Hedges and Tariq Ali on the subject of Jeremy Corbyn's election as Labour leader. I think it might have been Hedges who wrote an article called "Where Is Our Jeremy Corbyn?" And, you know, I'm just wondering, what to you is the significance of Jeremy Corbyn's election as a Labour leader?
Well, I think it's of tremendous significance because it signals that the Labour Party is refinding its roots as a democratic socialist party. The Labour Party was taken off the rails for a long time under the leadership of Tony Blair and the so-called Third Way. Tony Blair wanted to mimic the success of his friend Bill Clinton in the American presidency by presenting a party which was not overtly socialist or social democratic, but was trying to find a sort of kinder, gentler, hipper-looking capitalism, under which Tony Blair did a lot of things that people who think of themselves as socialists or worried about war and the rights of working class would balk at. So for a long time, things like supporting the war in Afghanistan or being involved in the war in Afghanistan or being involved in the war in Iraq or the bombing of Libya, these are things which were kind of supported in a knee-jerk manner by the British Labour Party when they were in leadership or when they were in the opposition. So it was a very dangerous period because no matter what foreign adventures the British and American ruling classes wanted to get involved in, whether legal or no, and frankly always illegal, the British Labour Party just snapped too. So I think what happened with Jeremy Corbyn was quite unexpected. I mean, let me just go back. I mean, I was born in Wales. I come from a Labour Party family. My mother was an elected Labour Party councillor on the city council in Cardiff. But that was the era of Harold Wilson, James Callaghan, and others, and Harold Wilson famously got into trouble with the Americans over his position on the Vietnam War and such. So what happened was unexpected to anybody except people who actually talked to the electorate in the UK. So the Labour Party was defeated in the general election in May of this year. Their leader was Ed Miliband. He resigned as a party leader, and it triggered a leadership election. So Corbyn considered standing as a candidate because there wasn't any left-wing candidates. They were all, in one way or another, Blairites. There were three other candidates, Yvonne Cooper, Andy Burnham, Liz Kendall, who were on the center and right of the party. I think what shocked everybody is that when Corbyn threw his name in the hat, it generated a huge amount of excitement and a flock of people coming to support him and support his leadership. So he won on the first round with about 250,000 votes for him. No one even came close. So what was he about? I mean, he was about having an anti-war position. He had been the chair, I believe, of the Stop the War coalition in the UK, He had been a member of the British Palestine Solidarity Campaign. He campaigned against private financing schemes. He was very front center about being a candidate who was an anti-austerity candidate. And you have to put it in the kind of an international context as to what was happening this year internationally. You had the election of the Syriza government on an expressly anti-austerity platform in Greece, and notwithstanding what they did with it later, the popularity of Podemos and the popularity of Bernie Sanders, who, while not as left-wing as Jeremy Corbyn, said something surprising to the American pundits and media, which was that he was a socialist. So bringing that word back into American political polite debate, or somewhat like polite debate. So they have Jeremy Corbyn as that leader. And since assuming the leadership, he's been under absolutely unceasing attack by the mainstream and even the sort of pale left press as a disaster for the Labour Party and so on. Notwithstanding that, hundreds of thousands of people have joined the Labour Party since his election. I'm sorry, I don't know if it's 7,000, at least tens of thousands, large numbers. Unions which previously had left the party because of Blairism, such as the Firefighters Union, came back into the party specifically because of Corbyn. In fact, I think the Firefighters came back in shortly before the vote on Syria. And he's got strong support from people like Andy Murray, who's the chairman of Unite, one of the biggest unions in the UK. So you have this extraordinary kind of split between the British ruling classes and Cameron and their mouthpieces in the media and in the Labour Party, which would include people on the front benches of the Labour Party like Hillary Benn and Tom Watson, who are just terrified of what Corbyn stands for, not Corbyn himself, you know.
Yes, I have to. I mean, I was very interested as soon as I heard about the possibility of Corbyn becoming the Labour Party leader, because here's someone who's an activist who never shed his beliefs, that he was always an anti-war activist. He was a founding member of the Stop the War Coalition. You know, he rides his bicycle around, promotes that, you know, eco-friendly bicycle travel. He's a vegetarian. He's a social justice activist. This is someone who's part of what the Labour Party is supposed to be, someone who represents the interests of ordinary people in England and who doesn't want it committing atrocities abroad. And you're starting to see people represent these kind of views around the world. Corbyn is one of the stronger examples. And he has indeed faced an enormous onslaught from the corporate media. You know, we use the term mainstream media, corporate media, very derisively, and now you can really see why, because here comes a popular candidate representing all these ideals that were thrown overboard by Tony Blair and neoliberalism and their equivalents over here in North America. And all these people now are rejoining Labour. The unions are coming back. A lot of activists who felt so disenchanted have come back. And he's really brought life into the party. We saw this in this recent by-election. But since he's an anti-war activist and he's had a stand against our continued intervention in Syria, there's been a number of manufactured controversies now. You know, people dredging up whatever they can against Corbyn. One of the most ridiculous, I think, was a simple article that had been posted on the Stop the War Coalition Facebook page. It was actually an excellent article by Chris Floyd, and it was used to attack Corbyn via attacking the Stop the War Coalition. I'm wondering if you can tell us at all about that.
Yeah, I mean, Chris Floyd wrote an article about the bombings in Paris. We used a phrase that the French government had sowed the wind and was reaping the whirlwind, meaning that the France was suffering a blowback for its interventions in the Middle East, its bombing of Syria, Iraq, its involvement in the war in Iraq, etc., etc. That was mischaracterized in the media as an apologia for the terrorists and of having no feeling for the people for the people killed in Paris, which isn't what Chris Floyd said. I've forgotten the exact words he used in the article, but he had said that it was he condemned, obviously, the bombing, the terrorist atrocities in Paris. He hadn't strayed away from that. He was just saying that the French involvement in the Middle East invites this kind of blowback. And he's not the only kind of the only person who says this sort of thing. I mean, in the debate in the House of Parliament in Britain, some of the people opposing the attacks on the decision to bomb Syria were arguing that this won't protect the British public against terrorism. It would, in fact, make life riskier for the British public in terms of inflaming tensions and so on in the Middle East. So, unfortunately, and I think it is unfortunate in a way, the Stop the War Coalition took Chris Floyd's article off their website in a sort of contrite manner. But it didn't stop all kinds of attacks from continuing. So the leader of the Green Party in the UK, whose name escapes me briefly, quit the Stop the War Coalition because of that and made some rather unfortunate comments about it. As did Peter Tatchell, who's an Australian who is a human rights campaigner in England. And they were more interested in attacking the Stop the War Coalition, but attacking Jeremy Corbyn because of it. So it all came to a head late last week when Jeremy Corbyn attended an annual Christmas party, but on the Stop the War Coalition. So that added to the absolute horror of the of the press in the UK, because how on earth would he go to that dinner after all the terrible, horrible things that Stop the War Coalition had done? And then, of course, the opponents of the Stop the War Coalition sort of decided to drag out all of the alleged evils of the Stop the War Coalition. So, for example, at their rallies, they weren't putting anti-Assad, anti-Syrian government speakers on the dais. That they had at one point invited a spokesperson for the Syrian government to explain their position and things like that, all deemed to be horrific by the people who wished to bomb Syria, and or the people who were sort of queasy about bombing Syria but still wanted the West, quote unquote, to do something again, quote unquote, about President Assad and his government, not really relying on the Syrian people to exercise their right to self-determination and have the leadership they wanted, which yes. Leadership may well be, particularly according to a poll the Telegraph sponsored, Bashar al-Assad, who apparently, according to the Telegraph, as I understand it, is the most popular leader in Syria at the moment.
Yeah, there's a lot of people that seem to want to speak for the Syrian people or tell us what Syrians want, but if you actually do an opinion poll and tell them that Syrians want to keep their government, they don't want to hear it.
No, no. And by the way, the attacks on Corbyn about going to the to dinner with Stop the War became kind of ludicrous. I mean, the Telegraph, which is a right-wing paper, obviously, in the UK, say, oh, yeah, he went to that dinner, but he snuck in the back door. That is, you know, he didn't want to, I suppose, I don't know why he went in the back door, the restaurant or the hall where they had the dinner, but it doesn't seem to be unusual for a politician to do that, maybe avoid the throng of photographers outside. Anyway, he seemed to come outside the front door afterwards, and he went in with Seamus Milne, who used to write for The Guardian, who's now working for him, and he gave a speech to the coalition to the just 100 people there, saying how strongly he supported the Stop the War Coalition, and you know he was going to be determined to attend that. So I guess what endears Jeremy Corbyn to the British public is his authenticity, in contradistinction to Tony Blair and Ed Miliband and, frankly, Hillary Benn and Peter Tatchell and all these people. He's not trying to please the editors of the Times or the Daily Mail or the Globe and Mail or the Guardian, for that matter, or the Independent. He's speaking to what appears to be the majority of the British public.
That's right. And people like it when he speaks up on these things. When he goes to the Stop the War Coalition holiday dinner and says, this is what I am, this is who I am, people say, this guy's authentic and I want to vote for him.
That's
and,
right.
You know, I mean, the Stop the War Coalition should have defended the Chris Floyd article. Most people who were talking about it weren't even reading it, because Chris Floyd's article about Syria and all that was very heartfelt and sensitive about why these wars need to stop, why there needs to be no more Paris-like attacks. He was very clear about all that, and he explained analytically why it had happened, and people just ran away from it.
Yeah, I mean, Corbyn was quoted in The Guardian as saying, quote, I've been proud to be the chair of the Stop the War Coalition, proud to be associated with the Stop the War Coalition. We're very strong. There are very many more of us than there are of those people who want to take us in the other direction. And that's what he said at the dinner for the Stop the War Coalition. And there were some wonderful people writing about this on the internet, both in little tweets and otherwise, and saying, well, isn't it bad that Jeremy Corbyn chose to go to dinner with his anti-war friends rather than what other politicians do and go to banquets put on by the banking industry and such, you know?
Yes, I think it's been mentioned that if Jeremy Corbyn had attended a Start the War Coalition meeting, he would have been assumed, well, this is prime minister material. You know, put him in charge if he's going to start a war. But if he's going to stop a war, we've got to send the entire media brigade against him. But he's held up. He's held steadfast, and so have most voters. And now we've come to some really important issues. And by the way, for those who are just tuning in, we're speaking with David Jacobs, an international human rights lawyer, labor lawyer. He's involved in many types of cases very successfully as well, helping out here in Hamilton with steelworkers, as well as on issues related to international law, genocide, all sorts of tribunals and prosecutions. We're very lucky to have him with us. I just want to say on that issue, international law, war, human rights, we have these votes over war in Syria right now. So votes over whether the United Kingdom should not start bombing, but continue bombing Syria, continue its illegal operation there. You know, a few years ago, there was a big mobilization in general in what you might call the Anglosphere, as well as elsewhere, against the idea that we should be intervening in and bombing and doing other things in Syria, because there had been a big push by John Kerry and the U.S. government not too long ago to say, we're gonna bomb Syria, we're going to bomb all these government installations, we're going to bomb all these places where people live, and that's going to solve the problem that we create by helping insurgents in Syria. And people said, no, we're tired of this. We know that these wars are just creating more terrorism, more war, more instability across the Middle East, and people protested in Canada, in the United States and in the United Kingdom, to the extent that the UK Parliament there, they had to hold a vote and say, we don't really want to bomb at this time. But now, because of the Paris attacks, because of ISIS, you know, because we keep feeding this fire, the Paris attacks led to another discussion about bombing in the United Kingdom. And now Corbyn is present as well. And can you tell us how it worked out with Corbyn being there and who was supporting this and who wasn't?
Well, there was a pretty intense debate in the British Parliament. It was supposed that a majority of Labour Party members were going to be supporting the Conservatives and voting in favour of the war. In fact, that didn't happen. The majority of Labour Party members, including the majority of members of the Labour Party shadow cabinet and front benches, voted against the war. There were sufficient numbers who voted for the war. And when I say the war, I mean bombing Syria. Additionally, as I understand it, the entirety of all of these Scottish Nationalist Party members of Parliament and the Welsh Nationalists, the Plaid Cymru, voted against bombing Syria. I mean, I wasn't able to see all of the discussion, but one thing that seemed to be sort of lacking from some of the things I heard was, there were two things. One, the question of the legality of bombing Syria, which seems to me, and not just because I'm a lawyer, I think, so central to this discussion. When you're discussing war and peace issues, why on earth do we not talk about war crimes? We left, the world left the end of World War II sick of empire building and sick of bombing and attacking foreign nations under some ideological presupposition that you're doing this for humanitarian reasons. I mean, Hitler famously said when he was moving into Poland that he was doing so because the German population there was being treated atrociously. Women were being raped and men were being killed and so on. And so he was attacking Poland for humanitarian reasons. At the end of World War II, a great achievement happened, which was the creation of the United Nations. And the United Nations Charter expressly, right at the beginning in its purposes, is there was created to end the scourge of war. And it went on to really enunciate some really important international law principles. One, that all nations were sovereign and equal. So in terms of the United Nations and the vote and so on, each nation in the world, whether little, big, or not, was sovereign and equal. Gone were the days of empires which legally had protectorates in other countries, which owned colonies, which owned peoples and so on. The rights of peoples to self-determination was recognized. But also what it said was there were some clear anti-war principles. One nation couldn't go to war against another nation except in extremely narrow circumstances. One of those circumstances would be self-defense. Now, self-defense is sort of bandied about as, you know, a rationale for attacking Afghanistan or even now attacking Syria to defeat ISIS. It's a self-defense. That isn't the law. That's a ridiculous use of the term. Self-defense in law is meant that you as a nation are allowed to defend yourselves against an absolutely imminent attack from a foreign sovereign state. You have to have basically troops pouring across your borders or planes getting ready to attack you before you can exercise that right of self-defense. And again, it's a limited right in international law. It only exists until the Security Council of the United Nations can get a handle on matters. And then, frankly, the United Nations is supposed to handle it themselves. The other way that war becomes legitimate is if it is legitimized by the United Nations Security Council under Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, and that has to be expressed. And just to underscore this, the NATO treaty itself is expressed in its terms as being subordinate to the United Nations Charter. So there is no way legally that Great Britain, the United States, or any other countries can bomb Syria without the agreement of the Syrian government. And that's the huge distinction that we have here between the alleged U.S. coalition against ISIS and what the Russians are doing. The Russians have been invited in to assist the Syrian government in maintaining its sovereignty and getting rid of the armed terrorists who are attacking the Syrian state. And that's where I think the anti-war movement gets a bit puzzled and confused, because the anti-war movement spends some time in worrying about whether Assad should or should not be the leader of Syria. Well, as I think we said earlier, it's nothing to do with the anti-war movement or anybody outside of Syria, actually, any more than anyone else can outside Canada can choose an enforce on us who our government is. The government of Syria is the government of Syria, and as of right now, this point in time, it is a sovereign state within the United Nations. And if you were to recognize that sovereign state as the current expression of the rights of the Syrian people to self-determination, then that is it. And you can see the extreme danger of the current situation, because whereas the Russians are using air power in Syria to support the Syrian army and the Syrian state in getting rid of the armed elements in its midst, Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda, Free Syrian Army, whoever they are, ISIS, of course. You can see how that can be done logically. In coordination between the Russians and the Syrians, they can decide, okay, the Syrian army, who are the boots on the ground, wish to retake a particular area from ISIS and clear ISIS out of that area. The Syrian government will coordinate with the Russian government in asking the Russian government to assist in using air power to clear the territory for them. But you can see in that scenario, and that scenario appears to have been having more success than anything else since the beginning of the war in Syria. But you can see how that scenario, the profligate bombing of Syria without any coordination with the Russians or the Syrians, is not helping in the war against terror, but is in fact part of the war against terror. It is disrupting Syrian government attempts to take ground from ISIS and so on.
Yes, but I mean,
Cameron fatuously said that there were 70,000 moderate rebels in Syria. That number he picked out of a certain part of his body, but it wasn't a brain. That doesn't exist. And there have been a number of articles on the internet saying, yes, there are a moderate force of some 70,000 Syrians called the Syrian National Army. So I think, you know, if there is one legitimately wants to get rid of terror in Syria, there's no choice but to back the legitimate government of Syria or get out of there, frankly. I mean, that's the only choice. If you don't want to support the Assad government, then have nothing to do with it. The problem to date, and it's a problem, again, that the anti-war coalition needs to understand, and I'm not saying they don't, but many of them don't, is that the creation of the Syrian crisis was started with funds, arms, equipment, material from the West. I mean, there now seems to be almost no question about that, that all of these various terrorist forces are receiving arms, weapons, transportation equipment, trucks, et cetera, from Turkey, from Saudi Arabia, from the Gulf states, and most importantly, from the U.S., who frankly, Turkey and the Saudis and so on are beholden to.
Yes, I think what you've done here is actually refer to two issues that are closely related to the point of being one issue, and the two issues are the Tony Blair-style intervention in the Middle East that we've had the last 15 years, breaking Iraq, going into countries, destroying them, like Libya, humanitarian intervention, they call it, and then they blow up the whole country, and then they say, we're going to be helping out in Syria, and by helping out, they mean they've been funding insurgent groups that became ISIS and that have been actually this Al-Qaeda, not like Al-Qaeda, but actually Al-Qaeda helped by Turkey, Saudi Arabia, United States, basically a number of NATO governments. And then when Syria gets on fire because of what those governments did, they say, we're going to bomb Syria to solve the problem. That's a Tony Blair solution. It's his policy and the George Bush policy that has continued. And now you see resistance to that in the Labour Party. There are people that said, we don't want this policy anymore. We don't want the Tony Blair bomb everyone, set the Middle East on fire, make cutbacks to social programs at home policy. So, you know, what can Labour do, given that a number of Labour Party members voted with the Conservatives to just randomly bomb Syria, which they've already inflamed? What are the choices now in the Labour Party in terms of these factions?
Well, there's obviously a battle going on in the Labour Party. I mean, far be it from me to advise the Labour Party. I think Jeremy Corbyn seems to be extremely well advised. He's got very bright people around him, like Seamus Milne and John McConnell and so on. There is going to be a fight. I mean, there's a fight, for example, this movement started basically in support of Jeremy Corbyn with tens of thousands of members. I think not all in the Labour Party. I'm not 100% sure. A movement called Momentum, anyway. And that's being attacked by the right wing. Oh, how can we allow such a movement? But they have allowed movements like the Fabian Society, for example, for years and years in the Labour Party, and the Fabian Society has published pamphlets, has got a membership list and so on, has its own point of view. I don't know. I mean, but you have people like the journalist John White. Read an article by him recently in defense of Stop the War Coalition, but he mentions that he's one of the people who think that the organization has to come down squarely on the side of Assad in the Syrian conflict. And it's not because one necessarily has to love Assad or agree with him and so on, but simply because if Assad fell, there's no question that the state would, institutions would fall, the army would disintegrate, the country descend into an abyss of sectarian bloodletting, because we know that will happen, because we saw what happened after the fall of Gaddafi in Libya, his assassination and the the consequent rise of terrorist groups, ISIS, et cetera, et cetera. There, similarly in Iraq after the murder of Saddam Hussein. So so that's what we have. On the whole, the Stop the War movement is a very good thing. It doesn't speak with actually one voice. The point that you were making there about the kind of liberal humanitarian imperialism, so to speak, of Tony Blair and that, I mean, you can see how hypocritical it is. I mean, for anti-war people to have to go out and make genuflections about how much they don't like Assad, well, at the same time, their government is wanting to destroy his country, but not wanting to destroy the country of allies such as the Saudi royalty or the Turkish government, which is brutally represses minorities such as the Kurds and so on that it doesn't agree with, or the Saudis, whose official record of brutality matches and surpasses ISIS. I mean, they publicly execute women for the crime of witchcraft. I mean, this is the 21st century. This is absolutely breathtaking. You know, the Saudi Arabians are involved in absolutely illegal and violent. I was going to use the word genocidal. I'm not sure that's a good word, but they're killing huge numbers of people in Yemen in an undeclared illegal war. That seems to be not bothersome to us. So then you've got to go back and say, well, why are we so bothered about Assad, right? Well, let's just sort of go down the list. It's one of the few countries in the Middle East which is a secular country. It's one of the few countries in the Middle East where it's a multi-faith country. There are people of all faiths there, all of them under peril from ISIS. It's a country where women have equal legal rights to men. It has it has socialized medical systems and so on. Why are then we so worried about having to criticize Assad when our government is working hand in glove with countries that cannot be described as secular, that cannot be described as giving equal rights to women, cannot be described as democracies? But not only are we not getting up saying we need regime change, we're providing these countries with weaponry and funding to a massive extent.
Yes, and I think we can all agree that the idea that the United Kingdom or Canada or the United States should be picking and choosing which government survives and which country gets intervened in, which country will be destroyed, it's all been highly destructive to set up this system of empire and kingdoms in the Middle East, and it's got to end. Whether it's George Bush or Tony Blair or Barack Obama, whether it's drone strikes, full-scale war, or the sending in of insurgents, these whole NATO-like campaign to wreck one country and preserve a dictatorship monarchy somewhere else, it has to end. International law has to be respected. We need the troops, the bombers, the ships to come home from the Middle East, and we certainly need to have no aggressive military action with regard to Syria. So, David, I thank you very much for your commentary. It's very insightful, and it helps us become better informed. It's shocking how little we know about Jeremy Corbyn or these debates here in Canada, but you've helped a lot to rectify that situation. So thanks so much for being on our program today.
Thank you.